familiar faces out there. I have, this is my first time to Holden Village. I've been here for one full week, and I absolutely love it. As a matter of fact, I was just telling one of the technological wizards around here that I would actually like to have a copy of the sessions. They're all recorded, and they made that option available to us. And last week I thought, oh, you know, I don't need another disc. I probably won't get to it anyway. And this week I checked it off because I have found I'm not very interested in, well, that's not true. I'm not so much interested in what I have to say. But the conversation last week was absolutely phenomenal. So I want a copy of that CD so that I can go back over those comments and mull them over. So I am sure that that will continue to be the case this week, and I'm very much looking forward to it. In my other life, when I'm not up here at Holden, I feel like I've been up here forever, I actually do two things. My area is clinical ethics, and I think those two words, clinical ethics, speak to what it is that I do in real life. I teach ethics at Augustana College, which is in Rock Island, Illinois, but I also am a clinical ethicist at Trinity Regional Medical System, which is part of Iowa Health System. It's one of the large hospitals in our area, and then it also extends into Iowa. So that's what I do. I think a lot about ethics. I think a lot about theoretical ethics, applied ethics, and then I think about practical applications of that theory. So what you're going to see today is some practical applications, but also a little bit of theory, some of the things that we have to think about before we actually get to questions that are of practical importance. And for those of you who don't have a chair, I think there's one here, and there's a table, and I don't know about that. So, is there anybody who works here who might know where more chairs are?
Here's one.
Right next door.
That's Marsha Rakers. I'm going to sit there.
Oh, there, that black one I think is open. So there is this one. And there is one back there. So, no, but you know, there's one right back there. There's one right back there. Okay, so I tend to be pretty informal when I do my presentations. I hope if you have questions and reflections along the way that you by all means join in on the conversation of what it is to be a person, what this thing called personal identity actually is. And then there's that little line on my description about extraterrestrials. We'll talk about them maybe more than what you think. So here we go. One of the themes that actually has characterized what I've done up at Holden this year is the notion of a story and the notion of a fact. I think that in our world today, in our strive for scientific objectivity, we oftentimes get stuck in the facts. We want more facts. We live by the facts. The facts govern our lives. But I think as important, if not more important, are the stories that we tell. And I think the best kind of view that we can take is something that blends those stories, that subjectivity, with those facts, that objectivity. So throughout what I'm going to do today is I'm going to blend those two things. But notice, we're going to end with a story. Because again, I think that will be a very fine way to highlight some of the main ideas I hope that you will continue to think about once we're done today. So here's the story I have to tell. Real story. Sometimes my stories are fictional, and sometimes they're not, and I will tell you what the difference is between the two. So here's my first story. It's a real story. It's a shock to me yet this day. But about 30 years ago, when I was a graduate student working on my PhD, I was again working in science and in theory. So I was getting a PhD in philosophy. It was in the area of philosophy of mind with practical applications, so that's where the ethics came from. And I dealt a lot with the question of what is the nature of personhood, what is the nature of personal identity. So in trying to keep those studies real, I did a lot of work with a place called Upham Hall, which is at the Ohio State University Medical Center campus. And in Upham Hall is where all of the psychiatrists work. Psychiatrists have very well-developed scientific views of what normal and abnormal personhood consists in, so they helped me work through some of my philosophical questions. Make a long story short, one of those psychiatrists was about to get a promotion to full professor. They were throwing a big party, and I was invited. And I thought this was great, because I was just a graduate student. I was in philosophy, not in psychiatry, so I actually felt rather honored by this. So the party was held in a large Victorian mansion. And it was kind of dark in the mansion. There were heavy velvet kinds of curtains, heavy furniture, lots of oak furniture. And the room was basically about this size where the gathering was being held. They had a number of thick, heavy couches in the corners, and they had very dim lighting, all right? So you sort of get the setting. And I had been told that there was a person I absolutely had to meet at this party. She was a student, graduate student at MIT, and her area was neuroscience, cognitive neuroscience. And she was apparently a real hotshot. So they said, you have to meet her. Her name is Eliza. So I was pretty excited about this. As far as I knew, we were the only graduate students, so that was something that would bind us together. So I came in, and one of the professors that I knew took me over to Eliza. She was already seated in one of these corner couches with a lamp kind of like that behind the corner couch. So it sort of fit in behind the couch. So I went over. We introduced each other. She sat the entire time. I shook her hand. And we started talking about bicycling. She apparently liked to bike around the Boston area. And she was also into cooking, and I liked cooking. We talked a little bit about novels. And about 15 or so minutes into this conversation with this otherwise complete stranger, it occurred to me as I was talking to her that she was a little strange, just a little strange. Her answers were pretty short, yes, I make that too if we were talking about cooking. Or I read that but want to read it again when we were talking about a novel. Or with respect to biking, yes, I just got a new bike. Okay, so short sentences, but otherwise fully engaged in our conversation. All right? Then the strangest thing happened. Bill Bates, who was the psychiatrist that I had worked with in my dissertation, he walked up to us, and I thought he was just coming over to see us and see, you know, how our conversation was going. But he walked over, and there were some people behind him who were looking at him, watching him walk over, and I thought, this is odd. And he walked over to Eliza, and he kicked her in the shin. Lightly, not hard, lightly. And I was aghast. Eliza said, ouch. I thought maybe he had slipped on something, but no, the kick seemed to be deliberate. All right, so there was a pause in the conversation, and then he did it again. He kicked her in the shin harder this time. She said, ouch, more emphatically, louder, and some of the people who watched Bill walk over to her started, you know, rubbing their beards. A lot of them had beards, snickering a little bit, and I was turning red in the face because I didn't know what was going on. So he kicked her one last time, and this time really hard. As a matter of fact, she was sitting with her legs crossed. He kicked her so hard that her leg fell down. She said, ouch, don't do that. And at that point, since I was doing ethics, I stood up and I said, why are you doing this to her? What's going on? And there was huge laughter in the background as more and more people started watching this. Anybody have a clue?
Yeah.
No.
What do you think was going on?
Right.
Eliza, I didn't know this at the time, is the name of a computer program, an AI, artificial intelligence program, developed by a guy named Weizenbaum, that they had stuffed into an automated mummy. All right, so this thing that they had stuffed, and very carefully, it turns out the psychiatry graduate students had done this. All right, this was the entertainment for the evening. So, but I was completely taken by it. I was completely taken by it, other than noting that her answers were a little bit off and a little bit short. Now, that was 30 years ago. Imagine what they're doing now. All right, and I've seen some of what they've done. As a matter of fact, anybody read Scientific American last month? All right. Here's a quotation. This is actually in an article entitled "What Are the Odds?" And they talk about things like synthetic life, asteroid collision, nuclear exchange, the cloning of a human, polar meltdown, and self-aware robots. All right. So I'm interested in what Scientific American said last year. sorry, about these self-aware robots. I'll just read you a little snippet. Today's computers and robots are for the most part designed to perform specific tasks under known conditions. Tomorrow's machines, though, could have more autonomy. All right, now we talked about autonomy a bit last week. They could have more freedom. They could have more self-determination. They should be able to self-replicate, teach themselves, and adapt to different conditions. Here's a quote. As the kinds of tasks that we want machines to perform become more complex, the more we need them to take care of themselves. This is a quotation from Todd Lipson, a mechanical and computer engineer at Cornell University. That is echoed coast to coast. There are huge projects in AI, in what is known as ontological engineering, all right? Ontological, that's a word we talked about last week as well. It's one of my favorite words, ontos. It means being. So these ontological engineers are creating, well, they don't call it life, but they call it artificial intelligence. So much so that the same person, Todd Lipson, goes on to say, I think that this research that we're doing leads down the path to consciousness and self-awareness. One last thing. The emergence of more intelligent AI won't come like an alien invasion of machines, agrees another prominent person who works in this area. Machines, he says, will follow a path that mirrors the evolution of humans. Ultimately, however, self-aware, self-improving, and self-improving machines will evolve beyond humans' ability to control or even understand themselves. All right, so the idea is the commonplace belief among those in neuroscience, cognitive neuroscience, and artificial intelligence is that this kind of development may even happen in our lifetime. All right, the tricky thing is, theoretically, we already know how to do a lot of this stuff, and we'll talk about some of that. There's a huge research project going on at the University of Chicago in this area. The problem is right now, our computers, our technology is not powerful enough to handle all of the data processing that happens between our ears. In other words, our computers don't have the storage capacity and the kind of communication among information, computer-based information, to handle what it is that our brain does. Once we develop, here's a word you all know, the appropriate nanotechnologies, or perhaps biotechnologies that have computer interfaces, that'll be an easy problem to solve once we have that technology, and then we have those self-aware robots. All right, so that's my story mixed in with just a few facts. But let me tell you another fact before we move on to some distinctions. Not only are the cognitive neuroscientists and the AI ontological engineers making huge progress in this area and getting enormous amount of funding. Neuroscience is the most funded area from the National Science Foundation and other organizations at this point in time. That is where we are thinking, all right? But in addition to that, there's also that work that has been done with the human genome. And they know that there are important connections to be made between, let's say, just neuroscience and what it is we can do with, say, genetic therapies, with genetic manipulations. We know, for example, that there are certain genes, they call these warrior genes. They're technically known as monoamine oxidase A genes. They are the genes that regulate serotonin, all right, so if you know that. Those genes regulate our more human kinds of behaviors. Right? They motivate many of our ethical or non-ethical behaviors. That information about those MAOA genes, in conjunction with this part of the brain, which I think is sort of interesting, is right behind our eyes, called the orbital cortex. That's taken to be the center of what makes us us. People who do research in the brain and neuroscience say that orbital cortex is where our ethics capacities lie. So much so that there's a very famous neuroscientist on the West Coast, down in Stanford, among other places. His name is Ramachandran, that's his last name. He has talked about something called the God center of the brain. It's that orbital cortex part. And one of the things that he does with some of his patients, some of them are actually graduate students and others are his patients, is he will anesthetize portions of that orbital cortex. And he will then ask, because the language centers of the brain are still intact, he will then ask his patients or graduate students, all right, or other paid volunteers, questions about their beliefs in ethics, questions about their beliefs in God. When that part of the brain is anesthetized, belief in God goes way down. Religious beliefs go way down. Ethical concerns go flat. When they come out of that anesthesia, they're right back where they were when they went in. Yes, I believe in God. Yes, I believe in right and wrong. Yes, I believe in good and bad. So Ramakandran says, you know, what does that mean with respect to our beliefs? All right, so that I find to be scary stuff. All right, I find that to be scary because as we'll see as we go on today, again, as I've already mentioned, those are the areas that are getting the most funding, so you should immediately think, well, how could that knowledge be abused? And secondly, that is the area where most practitioners in cognitive neuroscience and AI, they believe they're right. They believe that other theories that have existed in the past, we'll look at some of those, they are completely implausible. So if we want to know the truth about who we are as persons and what our personal identity is, then this is exactly what we ought to be doing. All right, so I hope that's enough of a motivation to get you interested in what we're about to do. Questions? Comments?
Scary.
It is scary. It is scary. For those of you who are familiar with Brave New World, there are now technical versions of that very book, which play out how it is that we do 1984 and Brave New World. It's very, very scary. Yes?
Why don't you take a straw poll and find out how scary?
Okay, what's the question of our poll?
Well, is this a scary thing to think that in a half a century from now, maybe robots will be thinking for themselves?
Right.
Is that scary? That'd be a good question.
You know, in that same...
Up or down, yes or no?
How many of you are not concerned by what I've just told you? One person. Do you want to explain why?
Well, I think that's part of the learning evolution is that we always encounter new things that we're a little unnerved about, but we have to learn into them. And I think we'll learn into this as well.
Okay. Two comments. Great question to ask. You had a follow-up?
Well, I mean, I kind of agree with her because we've gotten used to the fact that there are 10,000 nuclear weapons right now ready to go. And
yeah.
We're living with that. Nobody even talks about it, and I don't see anybody protesting it on the streets.
Right.
So we'll get used to this other thing.
Okay, three comments. I said two earlier. You have, Rickgate, gotten a third in mind. Comment number one. Certainly it's true that program that I mentioned at the University of Chicago that deals with that, they are motivated, I think most of them are motivated by the best of intentions, all right? So we'll look at that. It's called a BMI project. Secondly, there's a person, again, in California, at Berkeley, actually, who is working in this area of cognitive neuroscience. In the Scientific American article, he is quoted as saying this, "Personally, I've always been more scared of this than a lot of the other kinds of innovation science has created." And of this is in reference to what we've been talking about. Third comment, this goes back to what you said. I haven't said anything about cloning. That was one of the facts that I was going to talk about because it links nicely into the Human Genome Project and the MAO and all of that. But here's this quotation. Will the rest of us recoil in horror if cloning, right, becomes common? Or if these brain-mind interfaces become common. So if you lose your vision, we'll just replace your visual cortex, right? I mean, that's sort of where we're leading. We're not anywhere near there yet, but we are far enough such that people at MIT, these ontological engineers, can have you concentrate on your favorite color. They'll have 12 color options. They'll have you concentrate on your favorite color They will hook you up to various machines that will read your neural activity, and they'll say, oh, you know the color that you're thinking of? It's blue. And they'll be right 98% of the time. Yeah, they're real good at that. 98% of the time. They can read all sorts of other things too. But that's a very successful, vivid example of theirs. So, will the rest of us recoil in horror? It's possible, again, the Scientific American article, that we'll grow to accept cloning for various purposes as readily as we have accepted in vitro fertilization, which is your claim, right? That, well, we'll see the positive benefits of this, and we'll just get used to it. We certainly have gotten used to in vitro fertilization. There are, best estimate that I've read recently, is that there are between 17,000 and 20,000 in vitro babies, that have been born. Some of them are my college students. I actually know two in vitro college students. Right? So that was hugely controversial at the time that it was first proposed. Well, cloning is pretty controversial right now. We can clone humans, did you know that? We can clone sheep, we can clone all sorts of things since about the mid-90s, but we have cloned humans before. There is a company in Boston called Advanced Cell Technologies, and in 2001, they cloned successfully their first bank of humans. They let them grow until just before the embryo stage. This was about 3 weeks, all right? And at that point, word got out that they were doing this. They were receiving NSF funding. NSF funding did not approve the cloning of human embryos, but this was a private corporation that had received some of NSF funding, and so they immediately had to shut down. All right, that was 2001. All right, that was shut down because it was, in part, a federally funded program. What if it had been a privately funded program? As a matter of fact, the development of artificial intelligence and the development of clones, most people agree, will occur in privately funded organizations like Advanced Cell Technology, or actually some of the organizations that exist in Seattle. All right? And those aren't regulated to the same degree. So there are some questions, too. Did you have a comment?
I didn't think we were very good at the positive benefits of our scientific discoveries.
Yeah, I'm kind of worried about that, too. I mean, you mentioned nuclear weapons. I mean, it's the same kind of situation. And the question is, I think, you know, there are many scientists who have nothing but the best of intentions. And we've all benefited from, say, for example, the vaccinations that they have been able to develop. But there are those who always want to take it a step further or want to make something for profit. And that's where it becomes worrisome. All right. Let me tell you about the University of Chicago project, because I think that might be helpful as we continue to move through this. So BMI. BMI stands for body-mind interface work. Hot, hot area of research, massively funded for the best of intentions. We have so many soldiers coming back from the wars that we're fighting who have lost limbs. All right. So neuroscientists have said we've got to help them. All right, how can we best help them? Well, wouldn't it be wonderful if we could develop a prosthetic arm or a prosthetic leg that actually responded to what the soldier was thinking? So this is exactly what is now it's used in monkeys and chimpanzees in particular at the University of Chicago. So what they have is they will teach a monkey a certain kind of behavior, all right? So the monkey can respond to the command, pick up a banana. Then that monkey, gotta swallow hard on this, all right? That monkey will lose an arm or a hand. They will put in a prosthetic arm or hand, all right? And the monkey will be told, pick up that banana. That monkey can pick up the banana. That's body-mind interface. It is absolutely incredible technology. There's a small computer that can process the data of that command, send the corresponding neuromuscular information to the hand so that it grasps, the artificial hand, and then the monkey can eat that banana. That's the reward. All right. The biggest problem that they have with those monkeys involved in that trial today is that the brain rewires itself so quickly. There's that plasticity part of the brain, which is a great thing that we all have. But in this case, it's a problem, because the brain will rewire itself, and then the computer won't have the connections that it initially had in order to pull that off. They think that within the next 5 years, they will have that computer implanted in a returning soldier, so that that soldier can have some use of his hands. All right, that's the Chicago project. That's the BMI project. Motivated in terrific sorts of ways. But the worry, the ethical concern, is if they can do that, how else can they reprogram us? Right? So we have an incredibly violent individual. All right, somebody who has something wrong with that orbital cortex, or something that's wrong in their genetics, or both. A lot of times they have both. So with just a little bit of manipulation, right, we can fix their aggressive, violent behavior. Now we have to do it with drugs. But wouldn't it be better if they didn't have all the side effects of the drugs that they have to take? Just replant a part of their brain. Okay, so now we have a lot of examples on the table that we can work with. Let's turn to some distinctions. Any questions before we do that? We need a new language in order to talk about these issues. Our old language, as you will see, is probably what many would say woefully inadequate. All right, so I'm going to give you some of that new language, and we'll see how far we get. So the distinctions, these are older distinctions. Here's where you'll get some of the new language, I think, are helpful in framing our discussion of these very, very important issues. And I have found that you need to be able to discuss these issues well with the individuals who are working in these areas, because otherwise you'll not be able to keep up with them. I've been there before, right? You'll sound like a bumbling idiot if you don't know their lingo, if you don't know their language, if you don't know their moves. And that's not good, because everyone in this room, right, has good intentions, wants to make sure that we do the right thing, not see what innovation we can create and then figure out how to do the right thing, right? We want to do it from the start. We want to go in open-eyed. And so I find that you have to get technical, because if you don't have that technical language, they're going to progress much, much more quickly than the ethics that has to come along with the technological development. All right, so here's some relevant distinctions. So human and person are old words we've been familiar with for a long time, but we're going to manipulate those a little bit in a helpful sort of way. Human, just human, not human being, just human, is a biological term. Undeniable, we're members of the Homo sapiens species, right? Check out our genetics, and that can be confirmed. Person is a different word. It is a social, legal, it's called a social, legal cluster concept. So what that means is that we talk about the rights that a person has. Or if a human has those rights, a human has those rights in virtue of being a human person, all right? But person, in this social legal kind of way, refers to the properties that persons typically have, right? The properties that persons have in virtue of being able to enter into a legal contract, or being able to vote in an election, or being able to make certain kinds of important decisions, for example, getting married, right? So what are person-making characteristics? When you think about the nature of a person, what are those person-making characteristics? Emotion. Great. All right. Emotion. What else?
Well, there's a level of consciousness that's different from other living things.
Absolutely. Consciousness. Hugely important. What else?
Logic.
Logic. Okay, I'm going to use a slightly broader term. How about reason or rationality? How about a word?
Consequences.
Pardon?
Consequences.
Consequences.
Responsibility.
Okay. How about this? A conscience which includes responsibilities. Right? If you have a conscience, then you feel guilt. You feel regret. And so that's part of what I think the idea that you're getting at. You said something very important.
Language.
Yeah. Language is up here as well. And maybe under consciousness, we can also mention self-awareness. because there might be things that are conscious but don't have any self-awareness. Again, some interesting studies are coming out of neuroscience which show that people who are seriously, who are serious psychopaths, who have serious psychopathic kinds of states, they are conscious. So they can say, yes, the light is on, or I am so-and-so, or those panels are made of wood, so they're conscious of their environments, but they lack that. All right, so again, that's kind of interesting. We're not going to go there right now. But those are good person-making characteristics. Anything else that you absolutely want to put on there? Yes.
I think you have to be a human. You have to have a body, a human body, don't you?
We're going to get to that.
Okay.
These guys have it. Human persons, we all have this. I think we all fit this category. Let's number these. 1, 2, 3. I think we all fit in to number 3.
Does prehension come under human or person?
Person. What do you mean by prehension, though?
We have, I think it means our ability to use our thumb and our finger to pick up things.
Let me think about that. That's a tough one. I'm not sure where to place that because that may involve both. That may be here. All right? That may be here. Yes?
Where do we put a sense of safety and fear?
Emotions. I would put that with the emotions. Yeah. And again, some people say some emotions, there's a whole bunch of literature out there which says some emotions are, you know, more basic, others are more refined. So flight, fight is a very basic one. Regret, remorse, guilt, those are very refined, but they're still emotions, right? Because they grab you in the heart and they don't let you go. So it's not a cognitive state. Yes?
Where would awe and wonder and creativity, would that be also under emotion or where's...
Usually aesthetics, like what you refer to, are under emotions.
Okay.
Yeah. So I think this is a pretty good list, except for we might have left what out?
Well, I don't know. I'm just curious about historical data. I mean, our heritage.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So
heritage being their cultural heritage, Scandinavian as opposed to Eastern European or South American or whatever.
I think that probably is still going to fit here under self-awareness in particular. Right? So I think that that's certainly a very important aspect of what all of this leads to.
What about human beings as opposed to, say, the animal kingdom create religion, for example?
Yes.
What does that come under?
That certainly involves a combination of things here. So I think, again, it involves all of those. I think religion involves all of those, the capacity to create a religious belief.
Right.
Yeah. So I think for now, we're probably pretty good. The lists vary, but I think that we've got all of the basic components of these person-making characteristics. So you're thinking, why is she talking about this? Well, you'll see very soon. So we fit there. If those are our beginning terms and that's our first combination, look what happens. We could have, on this new view, we could have human non-persons, we could have non-human persons, and then we could have the boring category of non-human non-persons, like this highlighter that I'm using, right? Or like this chair. They're not human, they're not persons, so we don't have to worry about them too much. Unless it's a Mona Lisa, right? And then that might have some sting. So for our purposes, we're not going to worry about that. We fit here. What are examples of what might fit there? What suddenly becomes real examples here of human? Well, let's do the non-human persons first. Yeah?
Corporations, according to the Supreme Court of the United States.
Yes, you are absolutely correct. Because corporations can be held responsible, they can be praiseworthy, they can be blameworthy. And there's a guy named Peter French who has made the case that, yes, indeed, corporations are non-human persons. All right, so that's an interesting idea. What are some others?
Hell.
Yes. Hal
or Marvin
is certainly an example. E.T., if you remember that movie, is certainly an example. So this is why extraterrestrials those cyborgs, those androids.
The Stepford wives.
Well, yeah, maybe. They might fit here, actually. So,
or
well,
but you, yeah, right, yeah. So Star Trek all of a sudden takes on a kind of new dimension when you think in these terms, but that's exactly what we're heading for. So let's just make this complete. By the way, I might also point out that some people say angels fit here, that angels have person-making characteristics. Some people might even say God fits here, that God has person-making characteristics, right, and not human. What about human non-persons? Remember, I do clinical ethics. This becomes very important in some of our ethics consultations that we do at the hospital.
Well, somebody is in just a vegetative state.
Yeah.
Right.
They're brain dead or they're...
Right. Suppose we have somebody who's in a persistent vegetative state. They don't have any of those person-making characteristics. They did, but they don't anymore. And maybe think of Terry Schiavo,
far as
right?
We know.
Yeah, as far as we know.
I think of some politicians in that.
All right, I won't have you give an example.
Why not?
Well, I'm from Arizona, so I have a lot.
Oh. Okay, so we have people in a coma, we have politicians. Anyone else?
Some people in a coma, you mean they're being maintained by artificially?
Right.
Or some are not maintained artificially?
Yes, that's true, but it could work either way. Some are maintained artificially for up to possibly 20 years, and maybe even longer, with no sign of conscious awareness, no response whatsoever. Again, Terry Schiavo is a good case there. Karen Ann Quinlan from many years ago is a good case there. What else?
How about embryos?
Yeah. See why this becomes important very quickly?
Yeah.
What about embryos? Right? Very early stage humans. Clearly humans. All right? So you can see what that enters into. How about another example of a human non-person?
Well, there are some people who move in and out who have such severe psychotic diseases and illnesses that... I don't know that they're, you know, they still...
They maybe
move,
shift
they,
in and out of
they
personhood.
They shift in and out. If you're really heavily schizophrenic, when you're in that schizophrenic space, you're not functioning at the same way you and I are.
Right, right. So that would be an example. One other example that I have in mind are severe cases of dementia.
Right, okay.
Severe cases of dementia. Again, you know, if you have somebody with very late stage Alzheimer's, my father actually had Alzheimer's, and if it's very end stage Alzheimer's, do they have any of these characteristics?
No.
Clearly human, though. Clearly human, but can't enter into contracts, right? Can't vote, can't do a lot of those kinds of things. So this is terminology. These are the distinctions that become important, and for our purposes today, when we're thinking about personhood and who we are as persons, these distinctions have an impact on that. Because if we look at this category, for example, and if we look at, say, some AI programs, or maybe some extraterrestrials, who are far better at all of these things, right, then what does that mean for poor little humans? Right? What does that mean for us? Who are we in the end? Right? That's the question. So let me give you just a couple of quick questions, and then we'll take a look at some answers. I'm just going to read through these questions. I think they're pretty clear, and then we'll look at some answers, both historically and contemporary answers to these questions, and then we'll see where we are. So here are the questions. What is the mind? What are the marks of the mental? It appears that persons are the things that have minds. Humans have brains. All right? So is the brain and the mind the same thing? There's a batch of questions there. Let's put that up here. So this has the brain, clearly. This has the mind. All right? And the question is, what's the relationship between those two? Do we, however, also have a self or a spirit? Or a soul, okay, that's distinct from those? I do some work at MD Anderson at the Texas Medical Center in Houston. And they have at MD Anderson a little slogan which says, treating the whole person, mind, body, spirit. All right, now think about that. Treating the whole person, mind, body, spirit. All right, what are the connections between those things? How do we distinguish between those things? How do we know about these things? This is what we're working on, and you'll soon learn what many people think about that and that. Okay, so those are questions. Here's another question. If we consider those three things, how do they relate to the world? Okay, to this table here. I know what happens if my body interacts with this table, right? I know what happens to my eyesight if I look into a very bright light, so I know a little bit about that. But how does this thing interact with the world? And how does that interact with the world? Do these things interact with the world in the same way that that does? Very interesting questions. One other question that we haven't mentioned. There is this funny little word called, it's not so little, called introspection. It's a nice word. It has a long history. It is connected with self-awareness. It literally means looking inside. What is introspection? Is that my brain looking inside? But how does a brain look inside in the first place? How does all of that work? All right. Just like I said, that the person named Ramakandran believes that there's a God center of the brain, and there are many people who believe that there is an ethical center of the brain. There are others who argue that the ego, the I, is also located in, actually it turns out, overlapping centers of the brain. That's all that the I is. All right, but notice what I say. That's all that the I is. It all points back to that. And it all points back to that. So what does that mean? Okay, we'll see what that means as we look at a couple of answers. And what I'm going to do again is I'm going to take a look at some historical answers. People have been thinking about this for a long time. And then we'll end up with where we are today and what that might mean for our futures. Ha, look at that. I went from 5 to 7.
Six.
Where is 6? Okay, so answers. Here's where modern psychology starts. A fellow named René Descartes. I've often thought, you know, if I come back to Holden sometime, I'm going to teach René Descartes and I'm going to teach Soren Kierkegaard because they're perfect examples of stories and facts, objective, subjective. But that's not this time. Descartes, he was born in 1596. He lived to the middle, I think he actually lived to 1650. But he's known as the father of modern psychology. All right? He was thinking about this. He came out of an Augustinian tradition. He was very well versed in St. Augustine's ideas about these kinds of issues. He, however, had the goal, and this is a direct quote, this is in his Meditations on First Philosophy, he had a goal of putting religion on the same firm footing as science. Okay, that's his quotation. That's his little preface to his Meditations. To put religion on the same firm footing as science. He was a very, very, he was raised in the Catholic tradition. He was, at least in terms of his behavior, a very devout Catholic. I'm not so sure in terms of his writing. Okay, so he knew the Augustine literature very, very well. So he is an advocate of this position called dualism. Cartesian dualism is a standard kind of term in this kind of discussion. So he believed in, let's put it this way, an immaterial substance and a material substance. Those were the two components of what a person was for him. The material substance is the body, all right? The immaterial substance is that other stuff, all right? It was the mind for him. Occasionally he mentions the soul and the spirit. He does not distinguish between the mind and the soul or the spirit. Okay, that was an important move on his part to simplify material, immaterial. Okay, so he satisfied the church in that regard. But distinction between those two. And some people say, oops, to that move on his part. All right? One further thing. He did worry about how these two connect, and that's a good worry. That's a very, very good worry. Because if this is immaterial, if our minds, our souls are immaterial, that means, among other things, they have no location in space-time. They have no weight. They have no shape. They are nothing that we can access. All right? If it's material, they have a place in space-time. They have weight. They have shape. We can see it. We can verify it. All right? So we've got two, as Descartes says, fundamentally different kinds of things. Here's the important question for us. How do they interact? How do they talk to one another? How does your mind or your soul interact with your body? Well, here's an example. I think right now that I, this is my mind working, that I want my body to touch this thing up here, right? There, I pulled it off. My mind caused my hand to go up there and touch that beam. Does that work?
It seemed to.
It seems to work. Those are our intuitions. Neuroscience says, you're wrong. That's all physical. That's your brain. Your brain is the causal mechanism for the movement of your hand. As a matter of fact, if we mess around or anesthetize your motor cortex, it's just not going to happen. You can think it as much as you want, and your hand's not going to move. So how does the mind interact with the body? How does that work? Here's a very poignant example, a very powerful example. In America, it just so happens that 1 out of 10 people take antidepressants. All right? So you take this pill, and you know, especially if you have dialogue with a therapist, it will make you feel better. But what does that pill do? That pill does not work on this. So your depression is not a mental state. Your depression is not a mental state. It's a brain state. That's why the pills work.
It's a chemical state.
It's a chemical state. Exactly. There's a big book out there which is called The Myth of Mental Illness. There is no such thing as mental illness. It's all in the brain. All right? So that question about how these two interact is a really, really tough one. Descartes had an answer. Anybody know?
I think they're brain.
Oh, no. That comes, though. That actually presupposes what he's doing here. That area is the pineal gland. It's a little, Descartes was also a physician, and he had a practice. He did a lot of experiments, so he's a very smart fellow. He was also a mathematician. And the pineal gland is about the size of a peanut, and it's located right here about an inch in. Some of us have it, some of us don't. Some of us have more of it, some of us have a little bit less. But he noticed that the pineal gland was something that he only found in his human dissections. He didn't find it in his animal dissection. So he said, aha, that is the place of the mind-body interaction. Turns out he was wrong about that because there are humans that don't have the pineal gland and they still seem to get along just fine. Right? So what happened after Descartes? After Descartes, call this tradition one. It is the tradition that is actually consistent with many, many religious beliefs. There are people at Notre Dame to this day who are working in these areas with a Cartesian lens on. All right, so there's a whole long tradition that goes along with Descartes. Tradition two is different. Tradition two is known as the empiricist tradition. And the empiricist tradition is the one that we fund these days. It's the one that has the majority view on issues about the nature of personhood. And what this tradition does is it follows a person named John Locke. We mentioned him last week. He was very instrumental in shaping our social political kind of structure. And it also involves another British person by the name of David Hume. Actually, he was Scottish. Apologies.
Yes.
Apologies. Okay. So Hume, is also in this tradition. What Locke says is this, to simplify, it's all about consciousness. So what Locke has done is he's done away with the human. He's done away with the body altogether. All right? He says the body doesn't matter. Now that might sound good because that might sound like we're going in that direction. But it doesn't necessarily mean that. It means all sorts of strange things. It means things like if we have a person, be it human or not, and we have another person, be it human or not, we could take one person, and he literally says, take out their program, put it in the other person, take the other person's program, put it in the first person, and have something like what? A Prince Cobbler switch. That's his example. So think of your brain in terms of a computer program, an information processing system. No brain is involved, really. It's just the information that we want to take out of your brain, all right? And think of your brain in the same sort of way. That we could take your information processing system, put it in his operating unit, which is his body, right? Take yours out, put it in yours, and then who would be who?
Sorry.
Right? Who would she be married to? I mean, that's...
Where's Jeanette?
I don't want to go there. But it raises interesting questions. It might be worth my... Sorry, go ahead. Yes, it does. Yes, it does raise Frankenstein questions. Absolutely. Those people in the late 1600s, 1700s, 1800s were the first to have a sense of what this shift from here, from this stuff to this, might actually mean, what implications it might actually have. I have a good example that will bring in the ethical dimension if it's not yet clear. This comes from my dissertation advisor. He and I had very serious differences of opinion as I was writing my dissertation, both ethically and clinically. But it was great because that way, you know, I had my partner in argument. But here's one of his examples. It's kind of esoteric. He too was from California. All right, so suppose that you have, that you're driving down the road, an accident occurs, okay? And it's a very rural area. This is in the Midwest, let's suppose. And there are some cows in a pasture. And the person in the car with you has some very severe head trauma. All right. It just so happens, though, that you're one of these neuroscientists of the future. And you know it's going to take a while for the helicopter to come in and airlift you to a trauma center that can handle this. So you have your little black bag in the back of the car, and right there on the spot, what you do is a brain transplant, all right? They actually do brain transplants among chimpanzees today, poor chimpanzees. Animal rights would be a very interesting conversation we could also have. But they do brain transplants among chimpanzees, and suppose that your friend was involved in this, and he says, well, you know, it's never been done in a human, but we're going to give it a try because there are no other options. So literally, he takes out your brain, all right, because it's not going to survive in your mangled body, all right. He puts it into the body of a cow that's feeding on a pasture, all right. The cow's brain he does want to respect, so he puts it in your body and says, well, hopefully it'll go okay until the paramedics come here and then we can, you know, sort out this transfer that we've just done. So one more complication, though, in my dissertation advisor's story. Car comes, sees that an accident has occurred. You think, oh, good, maybe they can just help me a little bit in this situation. Turns out to be a lunatic, all right? Lunatic with a gun, all right? And the lunatic comes up and he says, well, you know, I have one bullet and I'm going to use it on something, all right? Should he use it on the cow? Or should he use it on your friend's body? Now think about what has happened. If he shoots the cow, which is our initial intuition, that cow's body is supporting the brain, the psychology of your friend. Or do you shoot the mangled body that has the cow's brain? Talk about a headache, right? I mean, how do you think yourself through that example? Neuroscientists say shoot the friend's body. Shoot the friend's body, because what matters about the person that you love, right, your friend who has been in this accident, is what goes on up here. And the only way we have the chance of saving that person is if we save the cow, which is supporting that person's brain. All right, that comes from John Locke. And I see we're almost out of time, but I gotta do one more thing. Hume, okay? Hume says, give it up. What Hume says is get rid of the notion of a person altogether. All right? So that leaves the body. But you're gonna lose the person. You're gonna lose all that immaterial stuff that Descartes still wanted to hang on to. Hume says the word person, the word self, is just a placeholder. It's just a convenient fiction. All right? So that leaves us, and Hume died in 1776, so think about the timeline here. Right? Hume leaves us with our modern position. Our modern position, and I can do this in 2 minutes, all right? Our modern position boils down to one of three. Here are the options in 2010, and one of these options is way ahead of the others. All right, here are our options for people who work in this area. Option number one is behaviorism, B.F. Skinner. Okay, what it says is that the mind reduces to the set of behaviors that our body engages in. All right, so behaviorism is the view, here's Skinner's big title, what is it, beyond freedom and dignity. Okay, we are beyond freedom, we're not free, none of our choices are free, we're going to talk about that tomorrow, by the way, beyond freedom and dignity. How can we be dignified if there's just a body? How can we be dignified if we don't have a mind or a soul or a spirit? So just get over it, Skinner tells us. In the 1950s, because that was just a fiction, the idea that we have that immaterial thing, right? Amazing things could be said there, but what happens on behaviorism is we lose that, all right? Second option is called identity theory. Identity theory had its beginnings in Britain, and it was in Britain. With a guy named J.J.C. Smart, who spent half of his time in Australia. And what he said is that the mind is identical to the brain. There is a factual identity between mind and brain. Not a meaning identity. It's sort of like morning star, evening star, but they both refer to Venus, right? So there's a meaning, the difference in meaning between these two. But when it comes down to the fact, it's all about the brain. So on this view, even though he's willing to keep this word around, and soul and spirit, right? Smart is willing to keep that word around, those words around. Skinner was not. In reality, when it comes down to it, it's just a word. If you want to get to the facts, you have to go to the brain. All right? So the third position, actually there are four. Third position is something called functionalism. Functionalism says the mind is just an information processing system. Okay, a CPU, all right? So again, here we lose the mind. All that we have are input-output sequences, neurons firing or neurons not firing, all right? And that's it. There's nothing more. How could there be more? Because we can't figure out that basic problem that Descartes couldn't figure out between how the mind interacts with the body. All right, one more example.
Who's functionalism?
Well, actually, the lead proponent of that is a person at Harvard, and his name is Hilary Putnam. He is the lead proponent of this. Most neuroscientists are also functionalists, which is kind of interesting because that shows you how they get to the point where they say, Body-mind interfaces, no problem. Robots in the future that are self-aware, no problem. All right? One last example. Again, from California, there is a person who, eliminativism, who advocates eliminativism. And he says, his name is Richard Rorty. He died a couple of years ago. He's got plenty of followers. His claim is, just stop talking about dualism and let's just be honest with ourselves and talk about that, materialism. That's all there is. It solves all our problems. You have a headache? What do? You take aspirin. Right? Aspirin doesn't work on your soul, on your mind. You want to feel happy? Take a pill. Right? The way Rorty says, this guy, what he says is, if you look at our behaviors in this country, all right, we act as though we're materialists, but we talk as though we're dualists. All right? So that's very, very, very unsettling. And it, I hope will leave you with a lot of questions. And on Wednesday, there's something else we've got to do tomorrow, but on Wednesday, if you have time, what we're going to talk about is how to dig ourselves out of this hole. How to get back up there to Descartes, if we want to, all right, and bring in an account of the mind that will stand up to the challenges out there. I have to admit, when I talk to, which I occasionally do, the brain-mind interface people, that word mind they only put up in there for PR purposes. But when I talk to them, if I use the word mind in a philosophical sense, they won't listen to me anymore. Same at MD Anderson when I'm there. They won't listen to me. Even though at MD Anderson, they treat the whole person. All right? Okay, so I have one last thing, and we were told by our fearless leaders that we have to keep to the clock, all right? I have one last thing. This is a wonderful story, a very well-known story, a very short story, that is a kind of segue, a kind of bridge between what I did today and what we'll talk about on Wednesday. So I have maybe 20 copies here, which is not enough. But if you have, if you can share one, that would be great. And otherwise,
you can read it. We're into stories.
To us.
Pass it out and read it.
Yeah, pass it out and read it. Do I have time to do that? Okay. All right. There. I'll give you that, and I'll read
this one.
Okay. All right.
We'll have one.
So rules are only rules of thumb. Okay. All right. This comes from. Borges, very famous magical realist from South America. Some of you may know him. And here he tells a very, very short story about personhood. All right? And he can't figure it out. All right? Which is helpful for us because we can't figure it out either. So here's what he says. The other one, the one called Borges, is the one things happen to. I walk through the streets of Buenos Aires and stop for a moment, perhaps mechanically now, to look at the arc of an entrance hall and the grill work on the gate. I know of Borges from the mail and see his name on a list of professors or in a biographical dictionary. I, like hourglasses, maps, 18th century topography, the taste of coffee, and the prose of Stevenson. He shares these preferences, but in a vain way that turns them into the attributes of an actor. It would be an exaggeration to say that ours is a hostile relationship. I live, let myself go on living, so that Borges may contrive his literature, and his literature justifies me. So there's a conflict here between the subjective, the I, the narrator, and the public face, Borges, the author. Right, that's what we're going on here. It is no effort for me to confess that he has achieved some valid pages, but those pages can't save me. Perhaps because what is good belongs to no one, not even to him, but rather to the language and to the tradition. Besides, I'm destined to perish, definitively, and only some instant of myself can survive in him. He lives on in his literature. The name, the objective reality, lives on in the literature. But I, the narrator, I'm going to die. I'm not going to live on in that way. Little by little, I am giving over everything to him. Though, typo, though I am quite aware of his perverse action or custom of falsifying and magnifying things. Spinoza knew that all things long to persist in their being. The stone eternally wants to be a stone, and a tiger a tiger. I shall remain in Borges, not in myself, if it is true that I am someone, but I recognize myself less in his books than in many others, or in laborious strumming of a guitar. Years ago, I tried to free myself from him. I went from the mythologies of the suburbs to the games with time and infinity. But those games belong to Borges now, and I shall have to imagine other things. Thus, my life is a flight, and I lose everything, and everything belongs to oblivion or to him. And then that last sentence. I do not know which of us has written this.